You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS
and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Tuesday, June 25th, 2013. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, an interview I did at Netroots Nation last week. Gianna Cadedal, he is a lawyer from the Center for Constitutional Rights in New York City, on their cases that involved the revelations of the NSA surveillance programs. Also on the program today, just now breaking, the Supreme Court has essentially gutted the Voting Rights Act. We will talk more about this tomorrow on the program. We're hoping to have Ari Berman on to get into the details of this more as the show continues. Also, Supreme Court rules on affirmative action and other issues. We will hear more rulings tomorrow in a fairly unprecedented, or Thursday. I think all this week we're going to hear more rulings from the Supreme Court, particularly regarding DOMA, the Defense of Marriage Act, also Proposition 8 out of California. Also on today's program, more on the NSA and revelations of another program in the administration called Insider Threat, which has more to do with whistleblowing and I guess classifying as secret information that is not classified. I don't know if I said that inartfully. Meanwhile, in Texas, state legislature full of morons. And today, we just got so much news. The president will be giving a speech on his administration's plans to fight global warming. Will it mean much once we hear what their decision will be on Keystone XL? I don't know. Just so much news today, folks. It's almost impossible to keep up. But we will do our best. It really is an overwhelming amount of information, not the least of which is the intense sort of coverage of Edward Snowden and where he is, which is in some respects the least relevant of all the stories that we have this week. So I'm not going to spend too much time on that. Because, again, that is, in many respects, the least substantive of all these stories, whether they're regarding the NSA or the Supreme Court or the president's push on global warming initiatives, et cetera, et cetera. Although I will say this, last night I was watching, I'm still sort of getting my bearings coming back from Netroots Nation, which was all the way in California. And I was watching Lawrence O'Donnell's show, and he was literally complaining that Edward Snowden had forced him to cover Edward Snowden's, the story about Edward Snowden's whereabouts, and he claimed that otherwise he would actually be talking about the NSA revelations. I kid you not. That was essentially the summation of that story, which I found quite stunning.
Hands are tied.
Huh? Hands are tied. There's nothing I can do because I have absolutely no control of what I say on this program. And as such, I've got to talk about where he is. And if I didn't talk about where he is, I would undoubtedly be talking about what he revealed. Because that's much more important, but I can't get to it because I'm talking about where he is. Meanwhile, we had talked to Ari Berman quite a bit over the past several months about Shelby County versus Holder, which was in front of the Supreme Court, regarding Section 5 and Section 4 of the Voting Rights Act. Section 5 essentially says that there are some states that must be pre-cleared. Almost a dozen states, but really it's by county. Most of those states are southern states. However, there are counties in New York State, I believe one upstate, one that covers Queens, in California as well. Counties that have had a historical record of attempting to disenfranchise some minorities, different minorities' voting rights. And Section 5 says that those counties that are under Section 5 must be pre-cleared by the Department of Justice to make any changes to their voting laws. Section 4 is essentially the formula which determines which counties are bound by Section 5. According to the holding today out of the Supreme Court, in an opinion by Chief Justice John Roberts that was joined by, and this is going to come as a huge surprise to you, Justices Scalia, Kennedy, Thomas, and Alito, holds that Section 4 of the Voting Rights Act, which sets out this formula that is used to determine which state and local governments must comply with Section 5's pre-approval requirement, is unconstitutional and can no longer be used. So Section 5 remains, but it has virtually no effect. In fact, I think not virtually, I think it has no effect because we do not know which states are bound under Section 5. The Supreme Court basically said it has to go back to Congress and they have to develop a new formula, which I guess at that point then is presumptively constitutional until it gets back to the Supreme Court and they reject it anyways because they don't believe there's any more racism in this country. I think Justice Ginsburg in her dissent, and I've yet to read all of these rulings, said, essentially, this is equivalent of saying, you don't need it in the same way you don't need an umbrella anymore because you're not getting wet once you carry around the umbrella. So the umbrella is no longer needed. This is going to have, I think, immediate impacts on the 2014 election cycle because you're going to see the myriad of counties and states, for that matter, who passed or attempted to pass laws that would have disenfranchised various voters, particularly Texas, that was reversed by the DOJ because it was found to be a poll tax in other clothing. You're going to see them re-implement this, and instead of the DOJ starting off by saying, no, you cannot implement this, it's going to have to then go to court And so we're going to hear a whole new round over the next 16 months of attempts by Republican-controlled legislatures, imposing requirements to vote that will necessarily disenfranchise voters, and then the court cases that will follow. It's stunning, and the impact, I think, is even greater than I have just suggested. We will talk to Ari Berman about that tomorrow. Later on the program, we'll discuss other rulings by the Supreme Court, some of which have to do with affirmative action, others of which have to do with, again, making it harder for individuals to take on corporations and providing access, essentially, to courts for individuals who want to fight corporate malfeasance. Also coming up in the program, we'll talk more about the NSA. We're starting to see legislation, or at least proposals for legislation, that have come out of the revelations. We will talk about the Obama administration's unprecedented attack on any type of leaks, whether they are have to do with national security or not, under their insider threat program. And yes, if you're hearing the sound of my voice now, there's every reason to believe, if you are working for the federal government, that one of your coworkers could look at you askew and say, maybe this person is a potential insider threat. So maybe we'll have a special section of the show to make it sound like it's not so much insider threatery. We'll work on that. In the meantime, this is an interview I did several days ago with Shiana Katidal. He is a lawyer at the Center for Constitutional Rights in New York City, talking about the NSA program. The Center for Constitutional Rights just had a case dealing with the NSA surveillance programs thrown out less than 3 weeks ago over standing. And we will talk to Shiana to find out how these revelations may impact that case and future cases. We'll take a break and then we'll go to this. Nation 2013, speaking with Shiana Katidal, the senior managing attorney at the Center for Constitutional Rights. Thanks for joining me, Shiana.
Thanks for having me.
So now, Shiana, you folks at the Center for Constitutional Rights have been working on NSA surveillance, spying, data mining cases for years now. And in fact, as we speak now, June 22nd, about a week or two ago, right as the Snowden leaks were beginning to widely disseminate, you had a case in the Ninth District Court that was dismissed. Tell me about that case and what bearing it has in this situation.
Sure. Actually, it was at the Ninth Circuit, the Court of Appeals, the level of the courts, federal courts, right below the Supreme Court. So that case has been around for 7 years at this point. You know, when the New York Times via James Risen and Eric Lichblau broke the story of the NSA's warrantless surveillance program in December 2005, you know, they said that this is a program that's aimed at calls where one end is in the U.S. and one end outside the U.S. and where one party is suspected by the NSA of some link to terrorism. But they're going around the you know, very permissive system that had been set up by Congress after Watergate.
This is the FISA
statute.
Right.
A very easy system for the government to use, and yet they're going around it. And so we thought, well, that sounds just like the calls we make all the time to our international torture, rendition, you know, Guantanamo clients, not really the clients, but their family members and witnesses and that kind of thing. It sounds like the kind of calls we as, you know, human rights lawyers make all the time. And exactly the sort of thing that the government would never be able to get a warrant from even the very permissive FISA court to listen in on. So we thought, well,
now,
it makes sense that they would listen to our calls.
Would they not be able to get a warrant because one party is in the United States, or would they not be able to get a warrant because of a attorney-client privilege?
It's the latter.
Okay.
You'll hear a lot of talk in the days to come, given the last few stories from The Guardian, about what are called minimization procedures. Anytime the government gets a warrant, whether it's a domestic wiretapping warrant or an international sort of warrant, foreign intelligence warrant under FISA, they have to implement what are called minimization procedures. And the main gist of minimization procedures is this. If you got a search warrant, it would say, search in this drawer in my desk for this kind of paper that relates to this particular crime. Very, very narrow. When they put a bug on a phone line, it inherently gets a much broader amount of information. Other people could be talking. I could be talking to my lawyer, and those conversations would be privileged, right? So the idea of minimization procedures is these are a set of rules that people doing the wiretap are supposed to implement to narrow down what they listen to, and it's and the main number one rule of that is eliminate attorney-client privileged communications.
And so that conceptually applies to the hoovering of information that they hoover, the metadata, the content.
Well, I mean, back up a little bit, right? So that applies in situations where the government's actually getting a warrant, right? But none of that hoovering is really happening under anything that resembles a conventional warrant.
Okay, yes, right? I'm sorry. So I've jumped ahead. So so we're back to this this case that you have in the Ninth Circuit with the presumption that you have been surveilled. And it would have been contrary to statutory the statute because you are protected by attorney-client
And also because they admitted that they were doing this without ever going to the court or, in fact, ever going to Congress to bother asking, right? So what we wanted back then in 2006 when we filed this suit was an order saying, you can't do this anymore. Stop breaking the law. Well, the administration, you know, voluntarily stopped the program, or so they say, in early 2007 in the face of, you know, the ACLU's parallel suit going up to their Court of Appeals. Our case got bounced around a lot. It got shoved out to Northern California from New York to be with all the suits brought against telecom providers. And it sort of, you know, drifted along for a while and lasted until now. And so the remaining claims were we want them to go and destroy any records that they have of surveillance of our attorneys, you know, that might be in the files of the NSA. Perfectly reasonable sort of claim. And a judge could issue an order saying, well, go ahead and destroy them and report back to me that you have done it. And you know, all the government has to do is come back and say, we complied with your order. They don't have to say, well, we actually did have some records and we deleted them, you know, which the government has always claimed, well, that'll let, you know, the enemy know about our targeting practices, you know, if we even admit that we spied on
lawyers. So in other
words,
the government could say, we certify that we have no records of any attorneys from the Constitutional, for the Center for Constitutional Rights, without having to in any way indicate that they ever did.
Oh, it's less than that. I mean, if they said no records, then that would show that we weren't surveilled. And they, on their logic, that shows, you know, Al-Qaeda something valuable about, you know,
no records remaining.
Right. We complied with your order.
Okay.
You know, we destroyed any such records as exist. Right. And the government still came in and said, you know, that's objectionable. And mainly on this very technical legal grounds that we couldn't prove that we were actually listened to by this program.
So you had no standing. Was this a question of standing in this instance?
Basically. Right. And the lower court had said you've got to be able to prove that you were surveilled. Well, a very similar case went up to the Supreme Court last October, an ACLU case that was brought against the 2008 FISA Amendments Act, the new statute that was passed basically to allow the FISA court to rubber stamp an entire program of surveillance just like the NSA program. And you remember Senator Obama back then was a key vote there. He switched sides, decided to vote for that act, which again basically just puts Congress's and the FISA court's rubber stamp on the NSA program, and that sort of took surveillance off the table politically. And so for years, you know, very little was said about this issue, even though our case was sort of alive and there were other revelations slowly coming out, including some hints that lawyers might have been targeted under the program, right? But because, you know, it was no longer a political issue, nobody wanted to talk about it until Snowden.
So Why was it that once this was revealed, let's for a moment say that your case was the subject of your case had been the idea that your information had been surveilled via this new NSA program. And it is winding through the courts. Monday, a couple of weeks ago, comes 2 days after it has become revealed that there is this wide program that is at the very least hoovering up the Verizon data. We hear Congress people coming out and saying this is the tip of the iceberg. Could you then have made the argument that we have standing? Because it's quite clear. Let's say you had, because I know that there's been a case like this filed by the ACLU that they... Could you have then said we have standing, this is indication?
Right. So what the ACLU filed was a case based on the top secret order that The Guardian published, which said they're getting all the phone records.
Right.
So the numbers that you dial, right? But that's a quote-unquote metadata program, and I hate using that term because I think it's kind of techno jargon. It's gibberish that, you know, Congress and other defenders of the administration throws out there to kind of confuse people and make them go away on this issue. But they're gathering phone numbers, right? The PRISM program is content-related, right? That thing where they're tapping into kind of the servers of Apple and Microsoft and Google,
right,
and all these other big tech companies. That is a program that is the administration has admitted is implementing the FISA Amendments Act. And that's this lawsuit that the ACLU brought that the Supreme Court said, well, you don't have standing for that either, right? So in a weird way, the courts have set up this kind of catch-22. Anytime you're not certain that they got all the records out there, like they did with the phone records, you don't have standing. But, you know, with the phone records, they have this top secret document that says, give us every single record,
right,
domestic and foreign calls. The problem is there was one party that actually had that kind of thing for the NSA program back in 2006.
Out in California, Northern California, where the lawyers accidentally got information proving that their clients have been surveilled. And how was that handled by the court?
Well, so yes, that was a Muslim charity, the Al Haramain Islamic Foundation, where they had proof that not just, you know, their communications, but their communications with their lawyers based in Washington, D.C., were subject to NSA surveillance. And the Ninth Circuit, in that case, ended up saying this document, even though the government handed it to you by accident, is still top secret. It's still a state secret, and it can't be used in this case at all. Not only does the document go out, but you lawyers who got it from them, your memories of the document can't be used in the case either. So the document is just completely out of the case. So you got to wonder, with the PRISM program, with the phone records program, okay, we've got this top secret document that The Guardian put up that says everybody's Verizon calls were swept in. But that document still has that top secret marking. Why isn't the court in New York going to go the same way as the Ninth Circuit and say, catch 22, you guys do have evidence that your records were taken in, but because the document is secret, we're knocking it out of the case. So that's
we are
that's
not
the
going to consider its existence in the question of whether or not you have standing. That, I mean,
right, you've got
this
to
is
prove.
So stunning. We got to take a break. When we come back, I want to talk about just how stunning and in many respects, I mean, you know, I don't like to use this word, but it's Orwellian. The idea that the proof that you have is invalidated, we're just going to invalidate it. We got to take a break. We will talk about this when we come back. I'm talking to Shaina Katyal. He is a senior managing attorney at the Center for Constitutional Rights. We're at Netroots Nation 2013. We'll be back in just a moment. We're back. I'm talking to Shaina Katyal. He's the senior managing attorney at the Center for Constitutional Rights. We are at Netroots Nation 2013. When we broke, Shaina, we were talking about how the court in the past has rejected claims, suits regarding surveillance and whatnot because the client or the plaintiff did not have the ability to prove standing, in other words, that they had been spied upon. But even in the one case that we have where the plaintiff accidentally got proof from federal officials that they were being spied upon, the court said, well, that stuff is top secret, so you have to pretend it does not exist. Not only that it doesn't function as evidence, you have to pretend it doesn't exist because we won't even rely on people's memories of it to provide you standing, which is going to have big implications in any cases that are filed based upon what Snowden has released.
Right. Well, you know, again, the PRISM program is pretty much the same. You know, it's basically an implementation of the 2008 statute that Senator Obama signed off on. And that statute, everyone said at the time, it's ridiculously broad. It could let the government sweep in every single call to Israel, Venezuela, or Cuba, you know, in and out of the country if the government wanted to get one order that said that, right? And then the phone records thing, obviously, you know, incredibly broad also. And in fact, it seems to be a continuation of something.
And none of this is going to allow for standing. So we really can't. And the problem here is that in one of the things that Mark Udall and Senator Ron Wyden were talking about, to the extent that they could, very elliptically, was that the interpretation of the Patriot Act, Section 215, was being interpreted by the government and in a way that they felt was wrong and that Americans would be shocked to find out about. Now, my understanding is that the government goes to the FISA court and says, in regards to Section 215, can we hoover up all this stuff based upon the way that this or the FISA Act was amended? Was it Section 7?
215 is part of the Patriot Act. So.
Okay, and so, and the FISA court ruled, yes, you can do this. We're going to give you a one-off. Maybe it's every 3 months. We don't know exactly because this is all secret as well. We're going to give you, you know, every 3 months come in, rolling basis, boom, boom, boom. We give you a rubber stamp. We're going to let you have the broadest definition of relevance, the broadest definition of investigation, the broadest evidence, essentially. You can hoover it all in. Is that how it works? Did the FISA court actually make that ruling? And is there anybody in there arguing against that in that hearing?
No, I mean, it's just like any sort of, you know, hearing where the government tries to get a search warrant. It's ex parte, which means it's just the government going to the court. So the court doesn't get any sort of sense of the other side. You know, in England, they sometimes have proceedings where there's somebody appointed by the court to take the other side, basically to kind of play devil's advocate. But we don't even have that here.
So this is ex parte as if it was a warrant, but this is actually building law, right? I mean, because this is building case law. And in this instance, we have secret law that authorizes the execution of this statute in a way that at least two senators thought was wrong. And there's no one arguing, and we don't know, there's no transparency.
Right.
About
the craziest thing is that the administration has said, oh yeah, this order is basically, or at least Feinstein has said, this is the same order we've been getting back to 2006. So they've been renewing the gathering of phone records. But the administration has claimed that there's another secret order, not referred to in any sense in this order, that governs when they can search it. You know, and so they're trying to get at this kind of sneaky legal argument that if we have a computer filter through all the phone numbers to try to pop up, you know, leads and suspects, well, that's not really a search. And the gathering of this huge database that will sit around until, you know, who knows who is president years and years from now, that's not really, that doesn't have any Fourth Amendment implications either.
Now, the FISA court has said, as of today, I believe it was, or yesterday, that the Department of Justice should have no problem releasing the basis of their decision to expand, I think it is 215. Are you aware of this? What are the implications of it?
Well, I mean, you know, they ultimately the government gets to decide what's classified and what's not. And so, you know, for the FISA court to say we, the FISA court, don't have any objection to releasing our past orders is really a little bit empty, because the government is just going to come around and say this stuff is all top secret, you know, for the usual reasons. So this FISA court never publishes any of its opinions. We've only seen, I think, two opinions from the appeals court that sits above it in its whole history. But it's basically a rubber stamp. The judges are picked by the Chief Justice. They've all been named by John Roberts, you know, and before that by Rehnquist. So, you know, they're super conservative. And then among the 11 of them, the government gets to go and pick from which one it wants to go apply for it. So this one they got from some judge in, you know, northern Florida, who was a Reagan appointee, who's known as like one of the harshest sentencers in the federal system. So it's not really any kind of check. You know, the other check that Congress wanted was that it wanted a report at the end of the year of the number of orders that were issued under Section 215. But if they issue one order that lets them gather 10 million phone subscribers'
right.
records, it's completely deceptive.
And if it's one order that simply says, this is an ongoing program, you know, maybe you need to check back with us every 3 months, but that doesn't really constitute an order. That's just a reauthorization. that's the way it could be working as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, look, the worst part of it all is that they don't even really have to go to a court to get any kind of warrant to get at your phone records, your business records, the records of your web surfing. According to the government's interpretation of Supreme Court case law, all this kind of quote-unquote metadata, anything but the content of your communications, is under what's called the third-party doctrine. They can just grab it with the subpoena from these telecom companies.
And remember, it's not based upon a 1979
case called Smith versus Maryland, where they said, oh, the phone numbers you dial, you're turning those over voluntarily to the phone company so they can route your call and bill you. So you lose your privacy interest when you turn that over. Well, it's completely a silly ruling, and it's certainly in a different technological time, right?
Right. It doesn't necessarily apply to what we're doing as to how broad it is.
Right.
I mean, isn't the central question at this point when if the NSA feels that they are legit, they have legitimate authorization based upon a terrorist investigation to essentially collect all the metadata or all the content, it appears, right? I mean, as long as they don't search through that content,
well,
they're
tapped into it with Prism,
but, right?
But they are actually apparently queuing in search terms on a live basis.
They're
content.
Allowed to hoover this all up based upon an investigation. They don't have to show what they're investigating, right? They could theoretically, mm-hmm. the answer could be, we're just investigating terrorism, mm-hmm. And that encompasses the world.
Right. Right. You know, and I think that's part of the goal with some of these, you know, quote unquote data mining programs. They want to build up a huge reservoir of information and test it retrospectively. They want to see, can these formulas
basically creating a library and going back and mm-hmm. dipping in as they want, as the evolution of the word terrorist expands probably over time. And, okay, one final question. What is the most disturbing aspect of all of it to you as an attorney?
I think the fact that there's been so much continuity with what came before under the Bush administration and so little political debate about it, you know. And Obama says he welcomes the debate, but obviously keeping all this material secret isn't any way to have it debated. You know, and maybe the most dismaying part is to see the heads of the Intel committees basically, you know, pretending they're part of the intelligence community rather than the sole oversight mechanism that we have in real terms for
so,
all of this.
I mean, so is it fair to say that it's sort of the lack of transparency? I mean, for me, the most problematic thing is that we have a secret law, which means that there's no way to check or balance it. There's no way to have the people express their will that it's wrong. Mm-hmm. There's no way to contain the growth of the definitions and the flexibility and malleability of the definitions.
Yeah, I mean, we barely know what's going on, you know, and the problem is that without a debate, we don't ever have the crucial question answered, which is, does this stuff work? You know, there's a lot of evidence over history that shows when you gather just tons and tons of data, it ends up flooding the analysts, that they lose the needle for the haystack, so to speak. And that also that when they're given, you know, complete carte blanche, they end up following their political prejudices. And, you know, in the past, warrantless surveillance has been used by Democratic and Republican presidents, Johnson and Nixon, against Vietnam War opponents, against civil rights activists. There's a long history with warrantless surveillance, and it's not a pretty one.
And without the sort of the transparency of data to its efficacy, there's no way to weigh to make that balance between people's civil liberties and the needs of the state, I guess.
Yeah, well, I mean, when we're talking about review by courts, there may not be a balance, right? It may be that judicial review actually helps law enforcement focus on threats that are real rather than, you know, create these gigantic systems with billions of dollars with contractors doing most of the work who are lobbying to keep the you know, the trough full when they don't really work well at all, when they end up drowning us in data.
Shana Katadal, a senior managing attorney for the Center of Constitutional Rights, thanks so much for your time. All right, folks, that was an interview I did a couple of days ago. We've got a lot more material from Netroots Nation that we'll be playing over the coming weeks. And tomorrow we will have Ari Berman on. I just want to talk a little bit more about just sort of segueing back to the SCOTUS, the Supreme Court decision today, gutting the Voting Rights Act. Back during the 2012 election, the Department of Justice stopped the state of Texas from executing a
strict voter ID law that was passed by the Texas Republicans in 2011. At that time, the law was so restrictive, and I would say that the one area I think that the Department of Justice has been good under the Obama administration has been civil rights, and particularly in issues of voting. Attorney General Eric Holder at that time called it a poll tax. The Texas ID law was so restrictive that essentially no IDs, no student IDs, only a special non-driver state ID or a driver's license would work. It was estimated, according to Texas's own figures, that somewhere between 600,000 and almost 800,000 registered voters, that's between 4 and 6% of all registered voters in the state, lacked the necessary ID to vote. As you can imagine, the vast majority of those were either people who were poor, disproportionately minority. A lot of those people either had no reason to have a driver's license, they didn't own a car. They lived in areas where it would be literally 250 miles to go to a state office to get the non-driver's license. The hours of the, I don't know what they call it there, the DMV in Texas were such that you would have to miss work. And so the law was rejected by the Department of Justice. That decision was upheld in court, stating, simply put, many Hispanics and African Americans who voted in the last election will, because of the burdens imposed by SB 14, that was the law passed by the Texas legislature, will likely be unable to vote in the next election, and thereby blocking the law. So it was never implemented because of Section 5. Within moments after the court struck down Section 4 as unconstitutional, essentially hollowing out Section 5 of the Voter Rights Act, the Texas Attorney General said in a statement that the state's voter ID law will take effect immediately. It was already passed by the Texas legislature. Now that the action to prevent that law from taking effect under Section 5 has been negated, Texas AG says that law will take effect immediately. I imagine that's going to go right to court. You've had a court rule on it, but it was under the auspices of Section 5 and Section 4, so this is going to have to be relitigated. Just to give you a taste of what the implication of this means, we will talk to Ari Berman about this more tomorrow. Coming up on the Better Half, a listener writes in about our music selections and wants you to weigh in as well. Andrew Ross Sorkin yesterday apparently says he thinks Glenn Greenwald may almost says he should go to prison. Then today supposedly apologizes. We will hear both those sounds. Louie Gohmert, Republican from Texas, says two things. One, sex ed will turn us all into the Soviet Union. And two, gives clues that he may in fact be a longtime Soviet spy.
Forget Edward Snowden.
Right. Also, later in the program, we're going to talk about insider threat. We're going to be talking, previewing President Obama's global warming speech. We're going to talk about what's been going on in Texas. Texas, really, in the news, they have they're en route to passing an incredibly restrictive abortion law, which undoubtedly is unconstitutional, which undoubtedly will not stop them. You also have a Texas legislator who believes that rape kits, which are a means in which authorities try to determine the ID of a rapist by trying to find DNA samples on a victim's body. Apparently, this Texas lawmaker thinks that will also prevent pregnancies in the event of rape. So every day, another tiny celebration of just how dumber and dumber this country gets. All right, we're going to take a break. The number is 646-257-3920. 646-257-3920 is the number if you want to be a part of the program. If you want to IM me, do so at Majority FM. Folks, every other day we get a new member. Every day we have a member who writes to me and says, I have to cancel because of financial hardship. To grow this program, we need more members. We have more and more freebies, but we need to convert some of those freebies to becoming members, so that we can continue to maintain the show, so that we can continue to grow the show. You can become a member today at majority.fm. You can also support this program by buying your Amazon crap at our Amazon link. It's on the front page of majority.fm. Scroll down to the bottom, click on the link, bookmark it, buy all your Amazon crap through there. We'll get a little kickback. You won't notice a difference. JustCoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. See you in the better side. Better half? Flip side.